Hi, Tony Hines here, and you're listening to the Chain Reaction podcast, all about supply chain advantage. Well, great to be here. You're listening to the news roundup, all things impacting global supply chains this week. Well, just as we're putting this edition to press, there's some news on the debt position in the United States. President Joe Biden returned from Japan to have talks with Senator McCarthy from the Republican Party about the debt ceiling. It's $31.4 trillion US dollars, and some progress was made on 25th of May, but there's still concerns, particularly by traders on Wall Street who are avoiding Treasury debt because of the uncertainty that surrounds it. There's only a few days to go now before a default would be likely, so there's a lot of pressure and little time to sort it out. And because of the delays, of course, that's putting more pressure on everybody. They're closing in on a deal. That's President Joe Biden and Senator McCarthy for the Republican Party. That would raise government's debt to $31.4 trillion US dollars. And that ceiling would be for 2 years while capping spending on most items. The Treasury Department has said it could run out of money to pay its bills. Treasury securities are used widely as collateral in the markets. And, of course, bonds mature regularly. And next month, if a deal isn't reached and the Treasury is unable to pay the principal and interest on debt, then that would really trigger a major crisis. In the short term, about $4 trillion US dollars will be repurchased for short-term funding, and it's used by banks and the money market funds and others to borrow and lend. So it stops the wheels of the economy from turning round. So it's quite a serious moment. And banks are already moving away from Treasury bills that mature in June because of this concern. Many in the market are not accepting bonds that mature within the year. It's already having a damaging impact. So we'll have to wait and see how this is going to play out. It's looking hopeful, but it's going to go to the wire. Well, next week, G7 officials will hold their first meeting on artificial intelligence regulation. You'll remember that the G7's been meeting in Tokyo in the past week, but next week they're going to consider the problems posed by generative AI. Those are things like ChatGPT. And you may want to drop by and pick up my episode on artificial intelligence, which is out next Tuesday. Leaders of the G7, including the United States, European Union, and Japan, last week agreed to create an intergovernmental forum called Hiroshima AI Process, and they'll be debating issues around the fast-growing AI tools. This first working-level meeting takes place on May the 30th. Takeyoko Matsumoto is Japan's communication minister, and he said that the first working-level AI meeting to be held on May the 30th will consider issues such as intellectual property protection, disinformation, and how the technology should be governed. Now, those are all important questions, of course. Intellectual property is an interesting one. Disinformation, that's what people are concerned with, how it will bias the information flows, and of course, how to keep control and governance of artificial intelligence. As tech regulators worldwide gauge the impact of these AI services like ChatGPT, which is backed by Microsoft, this is an important meeting, and it will be the first that might enact legislation on AI, which will inspire governments around the globe to consider what rules ought to be applied to AI. So it's a start of a conversation that's going to continue for some time. They're hoping to come up with some suggestions by the year end. They also called for international technical standards to keep AI trustworthy and in line with our shared democratic values. The working group will seek input from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, Matsumoto told the press conference. The price of Brent crude oil fell this week to $76, and that's because of falling demand. The weaker economic outlook is putting pressure on oil prices and, of course, energy prices generally. And if demand falls, prices will come down. The stronger US dollar is also putting pressure on the oil price, and President Vladimir Putin said this week that oil prices are reaching, or energy prices are reaching, an economically justifiable level. Interesting comment. India is importing about 12 times the level it did in Russian oil from a year ago. And it brings in that crude oil, refines it, and sells it on to other nations. And at a meeting of the G7 last week, they wanted to persuade India to limit the amount of oil it purchases from Russia. But of course, as we've reported in previous episodes, this oil is attractively priced because of the sanctions that Russia is up against from Western countries because of the war in Ukraine. And so it's sought outlets in India and China. But China demand is likely to be lower than expected. Oil, of course, and fossil fuel generally is of considerable concern to many. And it's to do with climate change and the emissions that are damaging the planet and the commitment to net zero by 2050. Shell had its annual general meeting this week, and there were many climate protesters that disrupted that meeting, protesting against Shell's emissions, which they say need to be lower and the company needs to have better plans to move to a greener future. So these protests against oil companies and other fossil fuels are growing in number and in strength, and it's having quite an impact. But whether it'll change things the way they hope to is another matter. World energy at the moment is under severe strain, and of course we need energy to drive the economies of the world, and yes, we need greener energy, but more needs to be done in terms of investment to make that green energy plan become a reality. And of course, it's the oil companies and the fossil fuel companies themselves that have to decide to make those changes as part of their own survival plans, and of course, to fit in to the new world economy as it develops. Ford announced it's struck a deal with Tesla this week on sharing access to more than 12,000 Tesla superchargers in North America in early 2024. This is to charge the EVs. It should, of course, help both companies. Tesla, of course, will receive income from the deal, and Ford will be able to sell and promote its electric vehicles and have the infrastructure to charge those vehicles. So that will help Ford sell cars too. So it looks like a good deal all round for the EV manufacturers. A Tesla-developed adapter will provide Ford EVs fitted with the combined charging system, giving it access to Tesla's V3 superchargers. Ford will equip future EVs with Tesla's own charging standard, removing the need for an adapter for direct access to Tesla superchargers. And that will start in 2025. So that puts Tesla in quite a strong position in the EV market in the US. And of course, it's a good deal for Ford because they have the infrastructure and the access they need to persuade consumers to purchase electric vehicles. Ford CEO Jim Farley said, "We love the locations. We love the reliability of your routing software, the ease of use of the connector, the reliability of it." Tesla had 17,711 superchargers, and that's about 60% of the total US infrastructure for fast chargers currently. And it can add hundreds of miles of driving in an hour or less. So that's what's needed. These faster chargers are really important. I mean, when you think of the old technology, you drove to a gas station, you fill up, takes a few minutes, and you drive off. And you can drive hundreds of miles on that fill-up. But the electric chargers take longer. But the superchargers are still eating up time because it takes an hour to charge up. So you still have to plan more carefully that journey time. But at least it's getting better. And only when consumers find it easy to use and there's enough infrastructure will they be prepared to switch in more number to the EVs. So things heading in the right direction. Good for Tesla, good for Ford. Ultimately, of course, good for the consumer and good for the planet. On Thursday, it was stated that Germany's economy has entered recession. Gross domestic product fell by 0.3% in the first quarter of the year. This follows a decline of 0.5% in the fourth quarter of 2022. And a recession, of course, is commonly defined as two successive quarters of contraction. So Germany's met the criteria. It's in recession. It's official. It's all come as a bit of a shock, I think, to Europe and, of course, to Germany itself. Finance Minister Christian Lindner said there are surprisingly negative signals and the economy is losing potential for growth. He said, I don't want Germany to play in a league in which we have to relegate ourselves to the last positions. Forecasts of the International Monetary Fund, which predicted recession in 2023 only in Germany and Britain, among European countries, appears to be coming a reality. But of course, for Britain, that's not the case. Britain is not yet in recession, and according to the Bank of England and other commentators in the UK, it's unlikely to happen this year. Household consumption was down in Germany by 1.2% quarter on quarter, and government spending also decreased significantly by 4.9% on the quarter. Warm winter weather, a rebound in industrial activity, helped by the Chinese reopening and an easing of supply chain frictions, were just not enough to get the economy out of the recessionary danger zone, said Carsten Brzecki, head of macro at ING Global. Investment was up by 3.2%, particularly in machinery and equipment. And in construction, investment was up 3.9%. Exports have risen by 0.4% and imports fell by 0.9%. But it's the massive rise in energy prices that hit the German economy hard. They're hoping that things will recover in the second quarter, but we'll have to see. The Bundesbank said it expects the economy to grow modestly in the second quarter, and a rebound in industry should offset stagnating household consumption and a slump in construction. That was published in the bank's economy report, which was published on Wednesday. Now, what's going on in the banking industry? Well, a banking crisis began back in March this year in the United States. On May the 1st, US regulators seized the troubled First Republic Bank, FRB, and they promptly sold all of its deposits and assets to the country's biggest bank, JP Morgan Chase. This was a bid to stop any further turmoil in the banking sector. And this was despite obtaining a $30 billion lifeline from 11 of the country's largest banks in mid-March. The FRB was founded in 1985. It's based in San Francisco, and it was the 14th largest US bank, with total assets of $229 billion and total deposits of $104 billion at April the 13th, 2023. It wasn't a typical mid-sized American bank. It offered wealth management, brokerage services, almost exclusively to affluent clients. The Silicon Valley Bank was the first to hit trouble in early March, and that exclusively made loans to the tech industry. In the past few months, three of the four largest bank failures in US history have happened with First Republic, the Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank. And these are the largest bank failures in US history after Washington Mutual, which hit trouble back in 2008. And that was also acquired by JP Morgan. The three most recent failed banks, between them, held $532 billion of assets, which was more than the $526 billion owned by the 25 banks that failed in 2008. It's said that the cause of the recent bank failures was rapidly rising inflation, which in turn caused interest rates to rise, and that meant that the decline of treasury bonds and government-backed mortgage securities held by those regional banks declined. Once confidence is taken away from the banking sector, those with deposits, of course, may rush to release them. And it doesn't take long to release them these days. You don't necessarily have to queue up at the bank itself. You can withdraw your funds electronically. And that's all it takes for problems to beset the bank. So is it over yet? Well, some people think it is over, but it remains to be seen. Certainly as inflation falls, as it is doing in the United States, that rolls back the liquidity crisis on banks. And that liquidity crisis is caused, of course, by regulations that demand that banks hold more deposits. But holding more deposits means that they need more liquidity. And if their income is hit with interest rates rising and bond prices falling, their asset base declines, so they have to get more liquidity. Banks in the US have lent $19.2 billion. Banks would like to see all those deposits the $19.2 billion, down to the last cent, guaranteed by the US government. Janet Yellen stopped short of making any such commitment. Yellen said that she had other tools that could protect those deposits and stop any contagion to the rest of the sector. The banking crisis is not just limited to the United States, of course. UBS, you'll remember, paid $3.2 billion to take over Credit Suisse. And basically they've said they overpaid. The price was too high, given the state of Credit Suisse. You may recall that Credit Suisse, prior to its demise, was valued at around $90 billion. Around $119 billion was withdrawn from the bank in the final quarter of 2022 because of rumours of collapse. There had been various scandals and, of course, allegedly, some mismanagement. This week, JP Morgan, that took over First Republic, they have 7,000 employees in total, and they've announced redundancies of about 500. But we don't know if it's going to end there. The banking sector has settled down a bit since those disruptions to the sector earlier in the year, but you just wonder if it's settled down enough yet. And obviously, the situation with the US government and its debt ceiling will obviously not be making it easier for the banking sector. This, of course, all plays out in reality for firms in their dealings and trade. You expect the banking sector to work as it should in the background and to support and facilitate all those transactions in global trade. And supply chains work and rely on banks. Now, this is an interesting news story that hit my sights this week, and it's about gold. We don't usually think about gold as part of a supply chain, but of course it is. And this week, the United Arab Emirates becomes a key trade hub for Russian gold, since the Western sanctions over Ukraine cut Russia's more traditional export routes. And this is according to Russian customs records. The records contain details of nearly 1,000 gold shipments in a year since the Ukraine war started, and it shows that the Gulf state imported 75.7 tons of Russian gold worth $4.3 billion, up from just 1.3 tons during 2021. China and Turkey were the next biggest destinations for Russian gold, importing about 20 tons each. With the UAE, the three countries accounted for 99.8% of Russian gold exports in the customs data for the period between February the 24th, 2022 and March the 3rd, 2023. Russian gold had typically been shipped to London, and that was a gold trading and storage hub for Russia's gold. But the London Bullion Market Association banned Russian gold bars made from March the 7th, 2022. And by the end of August, Britain, the European Union, Switzerland, the United States, Canada and Japan had all banned the imports of Russian bullion. There is a risk, of course, that just like Brinksmat and other major gold thefts, where they melt down the gold, they could melt down the Russian gold and recast it, and it would still find its way back into US and European markets with its source of origin completely hidden. So it's quite interesting, isn't it, when you think about Russian gold. Interesting story, that. Apparently the gold had been sold at a 1% discount. Doesn't sound a lot, but I suppose on high-value items, 1% is significant. Another interesting story caught my eye this week, and it was about lowering the carbon content of imported goods. And one way, of course, that countries decide to do this, and the EU has decided to take this course of action, is to introduce carbon taxes to offset the carbon in the imported goods. And they said from 2026 they plan to tax carbon goods such as steel and iron ore from India. The European Union approved the world's first plan to impose this levy on imports of high carbon goods. It will include aluminium, cement, power, fertilizers, and hydrogen. And it aims to reach its net zero greenhouse emissions by 2050. Indian industry officials estimate that about $8 billion of exports for steel, iron ore would face the tariff. But all goods exported to the EU will be covered by 2034, so it will put a significant burden on those imports. So the EU has agreed to bilateral talks to see what can be done to make this tariff more palatable. They have this carbon border adjustment mechanism, CBAM, and the EU impose steep tariffs. They can range from 20 to 35% depending on what the carbon content of something is. India said it complained to the World Trade Organization while it sought to resolve the matter. Both sides said they'd look at the effects or the impact of what would happen when these taxes were introduced. But the EU is quite clear. This is not a protective issue. It's not about protectionism. It's to do with hitting these net zero targets. I think what's interesting is how the net zero target is going to be hit. If you talk to ordinary people, they probably think that all these products are going to become cleaner, the energy content is going to become cleaner, and the emissions are going to become lower. But in fact, there are lots of bureaucratic solutions to the problem, which involve still making as much carbon, still having the emissions, but actually taxing it. So it's a tax on pollution, effectively. Transitioning to the net zero economy is one of the biggest challenges facing organisations, businesses and government in the next 5 years. It's probably the biggest challenge. And it's going to be a big challenge for people in supply chains to deliver some of the targets that companies, organisations and governments set. And it won't be just about taxes. It has to be about finding better ways to do things and actually taking some action to lower carbon output, not just taxing it. Taxing it's only one side of the equation. Hyundai Motor Group and LG Energy Solutions announced on Friday that they'd be building a $4.3 billion electric vehicle battery plant in the United States. Manufacturers must adhere to new US sourcing requirements for EV battery components and critical minerals in order that they qualify for up to $7,500 in tax credits under the Inflation Reduction Act. This act is attracting a lot of interest from EV battery companies and tech companies because they can receive tax credits, which is making it very attractive for investment. This plant will be built in Georgia and it will begin in the second half of 2023. And battery production will start at the plant in 2025 at the earliest. It will have an annual production capacity of 30 gigawatt hours, enough for 300,000 electric vehicles. Hyundai is the world's third largest automobile manufacturer by sales, and it's building the battery manufacturing facility in Bryan County in Georgia. According to researchers at the London School of Economics, they say that Britain's departure from the European Union has accounted for about one-third of the increase in food bills for households since 2019, and that's equivalent to about £250 or $316. Britain has been struggling, like a number of countries, with high inflation, but it's highest for food prices, which are up more than 19% over the past year. Although London and Brussels agreed a largely traffic-free trade in goods, a largely tariff-free trade in goods, barriers to exports and imports in the form of bureaucracy, paperwork, the non-tariff barriers, have caused delays and higher cost. The Centre for Economic Performance study compared price changes for food products imported from the European Union with prices of food from further afield. Before Brexit, these products had similar price trends. After Brexit, there was a relative increase for products more exposed to imports from the EU, and this has continued to the present day. Studies found January to March 22 to 23, the price of food products increased by around 3.5 percentage points more than those that were not subject to the Brexit arrangements. If Brexit hadn't have happened, the CEP say that prices would be 8% lower. Products such as meat and cheese imported from the EU have increased by 10%. Last week, the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, said Britain's departure from the EU had not been a failure. Well, I think there's a lot of disagreement about that. It's all to do with how it was handled and the negotiations that were made, and how politicians didn't have the mind on the job, and they didn't really get things done. Brexit wasn't done, and there's the problem. It's costing businesses and consumers a lot of money, and for some, it's cost them their livelihoods. The UK's inflation figures came out on Thursday, 25th of May, and the rate has fallen to 8.7% in April. That's an improvement from the 10.1% in March, and it's the first time it's gone below 10% since August last year. But a slower rate of inflation doesn't necessarily mean prices are coming down. It just means they're not going up as fast as they were. And prices are still high, particularly food costs. They're 19.1% higher than a year ago, according to the Office of National Statistics in the UK. And although there are slower price rises in energy bills compared to a year ago, they remain high. And that's despite a price cap of just over £2,000 due to come in a month's time. But energy bills are higher than the price cap. That's the reality. The Prime Minister in the UK has said he wants to halve inflation this year, and that could be painful for the British economy. Prices of energy and food are still too high for most people to feel comfortable. Now, if you take some of the products in the food lines, we can see that sugar, a kilogram of sugar, in April 23, it's about £1.08, which is 47% up on what it was a year ago. Eggs, £3.29, 37% up. Cheddar cheese, 39% up. Milk, 33% up for a 2-pint bottle of milk. Potatoes, a kilogram, up 28% at 73 pence. Sliced white bread, up 28 pence to £1.39. And you can see the prices are rising. Maybe not so fast now, from what the Office of National Statistics has said, but certainly over the past year, those are significant increases. Overall, it means that a basket of goods that cost about £50 a year ago is now close to £60. £10 price rise. That's 20%, isn't it? And we're talking about 19.1% here. Global wholesale prices of products have risen because of the war in Ukraine. Grain, oils, fertilizer, energy costs, all exploded. Rapid rises. And although some of those commodity prices have dropped back, they're still much higher than they were 12 months ago. Having said all that, and while this might be uncomfortable for many families, spending on food and drink is still lower than in Italy, France, or Germany. But many products, much higher. Olive oil, eggs, spices, all gone higher. If we take out food and energy prices, there's still a price high of 6.8% in April. So if you strip that food and energy cost out, it's still 6.8%. So inflation isn't going away anytime soon. And the speculation, of course, that the Bank of England may raise interest rates next time it meets by about 0.7% to stave off any further inflation. Of course, pay has not kept up with inflation, and that's why we have a number of strikes in the United Kingdom. Well, that's it for this week's news round. I hope you've learned something you didn't know before, and I'll see you next time in the Chain Reaction podcast. Now, we have a very special episode coming up, which you can pick up on Tuesday next week, which is all about artificial intelligence and its impact on the supply chain. So drop by and make sure you pick that up and have a listen. So that's it from me. I'm Tony Hines. I'm signing off, and I'll see you next time in the Chain Reaction podcast. Bye for now. The Chain Reaction podcast is written, presented, and produced by Tony Hines. Hi, I'm Tony Hines. I'm here to tell you about the Chain Reaction podcast, all about supply chain advantage. I've been researching and writing about supply chains for over 25 years. I wrote my first book on supply chain strategies in the early 2000s. Each week we have special episodes on particular topics relating to supply chains, and we have a weekly news roundup every Saturday at 12 noon, all things impacting global supply chains in that week. So come and join us on the Chain Reaction podcast. I look forward to seeing you there. I'm Tony Hines. I'm signing off. Bye for now.